Good evening. A lawsuit at The Hague challenges big polluters. The Sackler family takes the heat from Congress, Mexico's tortured relationship with the United States, and the fate of the Western Sahara. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News for Thursday, December 17th, 2020. The number of Americans applying for unemployment benefits rose again last week to 885,000, the highest weekly total since September. It was a significant increase over last week and higher than what experts had predicted. Before the pandemic, about 225,000 claims were filed on average each week. Meanwhile, congressional negotiators are closing in on a $900 billion COVID-19 economic relief package, delivering additional help to businesses, $300 per week jobless checks, and $600 stimulus payments to most Americans. But there's no deal yet. 20.6 million Americans are now receiving some type of unemployment benefits. And continuing apace in building the most diverse administration in United States history, President-elect Biden selected the first Native American cabinet member to head the Department of the Interior. The pick, Representative Deb Haaland of New Mexico, is a member of the Laguna Pueblo tribe. She's one of the first two Native American women elected to Congress alongside Representative Charisse Davids, a Kansas Democrat. The Interior Department has significant responsibility over Native lands. And a group of environmental organizations backed by thousands of Dutch citizens launched a civil case Tuesday against the energy giant Shell, asking a court to order the multinational to commit to reining in its carbon emissions 45% by the year 2030. Over 2 weeks of court proceedings, lawyers for Friends of the Earth Netherlands have argued Shell is violating human rights by extracting fossil fuels and undermining the Paris Agreement's aim of keeping temperature rises below 1.5 degrees Celsius. Outside the courthouse, a spokesperson for the Dutch environmental group spoke with reporters.
Well, of course, Milieudefensie has been working on big oil companies and Shell for many decades, and we have been talking with them, we have been doing many campaigns, and we have been seeing that they're not willing to move, at least not enough. So for us, it's a sort of last resort, actually. It's not our wish to go to court, but if Shell doesn't move quickly enough, then for us, it's a sort of last resort. And it's also a signal to the politics, actually, globally, that they have to come up with rules for big companies as Shell. Because at the end, it's up to the politics, of course. But if Shell is not willing to move quickly enough, then for our idea is to go to court and ask the court to come to a judgment. The court case is on behalf not only of Milieudefensie, but also six other environmental organizations, but also on behalf of more than 17,000 individuals from the Netherlands. And Milieudefensie has been working in a campaign to gather all these people. And for us, it's a sign, a clear sign, that so many people want Shell to change their policy. Well, Shell says the individuals, the consumers are responsible, the politics are responsible, the international community is responsible. We are not responsible. We just play a role and we just provide what people ask for. And of course, in a sense, we agree with Shell that it's up to the politics at the end to come with good rulings. But as we have seen, that Shell has big influence on politics as well. They have a big lobby machine, a big PR machine. We say you have your own responsibility anyway.
And a spokesperson for Friends of the Earth United States is Kate DeAngelis. She says the Dutch case is one of a growing flood of environmental lawsuits around the world.
It's not just against Shell. We're seeing a case against the UK government for its overseas fossil fuel financing in Mozambique. And we're just seeing a lot of these types of court cases trying to hold these companies and governments accountable in all different types of ways. And so I don't have a crystal ball as far as how this case is going to turn out, but I'm feeling more and more optimistic that we will be able to hold these companies accountable for the emissions that they are emitting and the pollution and health impacts that they're causing.
They're not asking for money.
The bigger issue is trying to get them to reduce their emissions. And so getting that goal could have lasting impacts on the health and air quality and the environment at large and the climate. And I think that that would have a lasting impact for generations to come rather than just a short-term economic payout or financial payout.
How did it come to a lawsuit? There was some talk. I mean, Shell, for example, has been saying that it's trying to reduce its carbon footprint. Why did the activists feel they had to launch a lawsuit?
a lot of companies, we see Shell, Exxon, BP, a lot of these oil giants are putting out statements that they are trying to reduce their environmental impact, but a lot of it, frankly, is greenwashing. And if we really want to hold these types of companies accountable, the best place, unfortunately, is in the courtroom.
What's greenwashing?
Greenwashing is when a company tries to say that they're doing something for the environment because that's what consumers want to hear, but that they're not actually taking real action that will have meaningful impact. So here, Shell and other oil companies are saying, oh, yeah, we are looking into being net zero, or which, you know, means no, quote unquote, no emissions, or that they are trying to support more renewables. But in reality, they're not actually doing that much that will have a real impact to lower their emissions or shift their portfolio away from fossil fuels towards renewables.
What's the specific problem with Shell, and what are they doing around the world that is anything particularly onerous?
Shell has been involved in some pretty terrible projects all over the world, including in Nigeria. There's some cases against them there. So, yeah, unfortunately, a lot of times these companies don't really care about the impacts on local communities. And so it's not it's about the climate, but also about the negative impacts that these projects that they make billions of dollars off of every year, the negative impacts that they have on those local communities from polluting their environment, their water, their air.
Mm-hmm. All right. Anything you'd like to add?
We're really hopeful that Friends of the Earth Netherlands will be successful with this case, as well as the case of other Friends of the Earth groups like those in Friends of the Earth, England, Wales, and Northern Ireland, and hopefully other cases around the world that will finally begin to hold these companies accountable for their pollution.
Kate DeAngelis is a spokesperson for Friends of the Earth United States. Shell argues it's already working on transitioning from fossil fuels to sustainable sources, cautioning the three-judge panel that a victory for the environmental groups could open the floodgates to countless similar cases. Two of the owners of the company that makes OxyContin told the congressional committee today the powerful prescription painkiller has played a role in the national opioid crisis, but they stopped short of apologizing. David Sackler, a member of the family that owns Purdue Pharma, said in a rare appearance in a public forum, "I want to express my family's deep sadness about the opioid crisis." Purdue CEO Craig Landau testified, saying the company accepts full responsibility. But House members weren't hearing any excuses. Representative Jim Cooper, a Tennessee Democrat, said the company was the worst in United States history.
Folks like Anna Lemke, L-E-M-B-K-E, an addiction specialist at Stanford University, wrote a book way back in 2016 called The Drug Dealer MD. It pointed out a lot of the issues that we're dealing with in the hearing today. Do you know if any members of the board of directors read Dr. Anna Lemke's book or were aware of that book?
I don't know if any members of the board of directors read a specific book. No.
Have you read it?
I have not read it.
I used to teach health policy at Vanderbilt Business School, and I required all of my students to read it. So perhaps the students at Vanderbilt were ahead of the board of directors at Purdue. Because again, if you're not interested in discovering the truth, and if your salary depends on your not understanding the truth, then you're not going to pursue the truth.
I'm sorry, I didn't take that as a question. Can you rephrase it, please, Congressman?
Watching you testify makes my blood boil. I'm not sure that I'm aware of any family in America that's more evil than yours.
Tennessee Democrat Representative Jim Cooper questioning David Sackler, a board member of Purdue Pharma, maker of OxyContin. The Sackler family denies any personal wrongdoing in the opioid crisis. They face thousands of civil claims against them and Purdue Pharma by states and cities. The drug the company marketed as OxyContin, an opioid, is blamed for fueling an epidemic that killed more than 400,000 people. The scorn was bipartisan as Kentucky Republican James Comer began by saying there's little agreed on in this committee outside of the crimes of Purdue Pharma.
And to the Sackler family and Purdue Pharma, let me be as clear as I can be. You all are bad actors, and there's no excuse for what you did. You know, in the beginning, you could make the argument that you didn't realize that this drug, which was possibly created to prevent pain, would become addictive and create the havoc that it's created over the past decade. But you did learn that. And you have tried every way in the world to continue to market that product, and you profited all along the way. Kentucky has one of the highest incarceration percentages in the nation per capita. I think it is the highest in the nation. And the overwhelming majority of people who are incarcerated in Kentucky are there because of drug crimes. They've had to forfeit their assets. They have broken homes. And the cost to society is immeasurable. But you all have created the same harm to society. Yet you're one of the wealthiest families in America. I hope that the courts hold you accountable. I hope that the states where you are domiciled and where you operate in the future have a watchful eye on you. And I hope that a story like this, a story like yours, never happens again. With that, Madam Chair, I yield back.
Kentucky Republican James Cormer. And in more news from the nation's capital, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez came to the defense of President-elect Joe Biden's incoming deputy chief of staff on Thursday after GOP criticism of the top aide's expletive-laden remarks about Republicans. Ocasio-Cortez weighed in after Senator Marco Rubio knocked Biden's campaign manager Jen O'Malley-Dillon for calling GOP lawmakers a bunch of effers in a recent interview with Glamour magazine. Ocasio-Cortez pushed back, pointing to an incident earlier this year when a House Republican accosted her on the Capitol steps and uttered effing bitch. You're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. This week, Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador and Brazil's Jair Bolsonaro became the last Latin American leaders to congratulate U.S. President-elect Joe Biden. López Obrador's letter to Biden was chilly. AMLO, as he's called, had a surprisingly warm relationship with President Trump, despite threats from Trump to make Mexico pay for his border wall. The Mexican government has reacted angrily to U.S. intervention in the country's drug corruption problem. On Tuesday, the lower house of Mexico's Congress passed a bill that would strip U.S. drug agents working in Mexico of their diplomatic immunity and force the U.S. to share intelligence with Mexico's military. The vote came after the United States arrested a top Mexican general on drug charges and then later released the general without charges. An independent journalist and filmmaker based in Cuernavaca, Mexico, is Greg Berger.
Undercover operations led by U.S. anti-drug authorities that have had negative consequences. The last major case that came public knowledge was, of course, Fast and Furious, the arms running affair that happened under the Obama administration. Long before that, of course, going back to the era of Richard Nixon, the war on drugs has really wreaked havoc on Mexico. And there's been a lot of resentment, both from regular citizens and also local law enforcement who feel they've been swept aside while U.S. agents act with impunity. And that's the case here in the state of Morelos, where I live, where people that I know that are police officers were taken aback when they came into contact with U.S. agents who were armed and operating as if it were their own country. That's been a very humiliating thing to have to shoulder for all these decades and with very little benefit for Mexico. One of the things that López Obrador, the current president of Mexico, wants to do is change the relationship with the United States to be truly one of equals. And in order to do that, at the very least, I think they want to make sure that they're in control of those agents that are acting, foreign or otherwise, on Mexican soil. So I think it's very reasonable.
What were the chain of events that led to this law being passed?
Yesterday, López Obrador sent a letter to Joe Biden congratulating him on his election. He was waiting for the Electoral College to vote. He knew full well that Biden won the election immediately after the elections. But López Obrador has been very sensitive to protocol given the history of electoral fraud in Mexico. In the letter, there are two paragraphs of substance. One, mentions Lopez Obrador would like to thank Biden for his welcoming attitude towards migrants, both from Mexico and Central America, and inviting him to work together on eliminating the need to migrate and on improving conditions in Central America. That, in fact, was a policy platform in both Lopez Obrador's campaign and in Joe Biden's campaign. So I think that he was bending over backwards, Lopez Obrador, to talk about that point on which they can work together. But he also said in another paragraph that he wants to make sure that the new relationship is forged in a tone of mutual respect as equals and in respect for each country's respective sovereignty. And that, of course, is addressing this issue, the issue of the decades-long war on drugs in Mexico and the negative effects that's had. It's encouraged violence and hasn't reduced it. It's going to be difficult. The relationship with Trump was very easy. It was insulting to Mexico, but it was very easy because Trump just wanted to show that he was getting tough on migrants and a new free trade agreement. That's all he wanted. The Biden administration is going to want much more, and that's going to be complicated, but I don't think that that's a bad thing. I think sometimes a complex relationship can be a better relationship.
General Salvador Cienfuegos Cepeda, his arrest, what's going on there? Is there that much corruption within the higher levels of the Mexican government?
That's not a surprise to anyone, and I don't think that any average citizen here in Mexico has any doubt that Cienfuegos was probably involved. What's affecting and hurting the lives of ordinary Mexicans is not drug cartel crime. It's the kind of low-level crime that has spiraled out of control as a result of the war on drugs. And it's a much higher level of priority to make sure that the United States is respecting Mexico's sovereignty.
How is the drug legalization, decriminalization movement or push going on in Mexico right now?
There's been a lot of progress. It's been sort of a few steps forward, a few steps back. There are measures that were just passed in Congress that, yes, legalized the possession and the cultivation of marijuana, although they still haven't completely finished issuing final regulations on what that's actually going to look like. There are two people within the movement to legalize marijuana. One wants to make sure that the government is the only agency that's involved in the selling and marketing and licensing of marijuana products. There's another political lobby that wants to make sure that ordinary citizens can grow their own marijuana. And it looks like there's going to be a mixture of both. That looks like it's going to be the outcome.
Greg Berger is an independent journalist and filmmaker based in Cuernavaca, Mexico. And the fallout continues from the peace deal worked out by the United States between Israel and the Kingdom of Morocco. Senior Trump aide and son-in-law Jared Kushner will lead an American-Israeli delegation to Morocco next week in order to advance normalization talks between the two countries. The United States has, in return, signed a proclamation recognizing Moroccan sovereignty over the contested Western Sahara. The Trump administration also moved forward with $1 billion in sales of drones and precision-guided weapons to Morocco on Friday, sending a notice to Congress about the potential deals. Palestinian-born peace activist who's been to the Western Sahara is Mubarak Awad. He says a deal is a cover for annexation.
The Western Sahara was so important to me. I have been there several times and met with the leadership there and met with the leadership in Morocco to try to have a resolution, even with the people in Algeria. The difficulty is that Western Sahara are very, very simple people. And their number is not huge. It's nearly a little bit over 500,000 people. But Morocco is interested in three things. They are interested, first, that they have the phosphate, okay, deposits, which Morocco is using that to get money for Morocco. And the fishing, which is a good amount of nice areas of fishing at the sea there, and the iron ore. And they have been all the time dealing with Morocco as trying to get a referendum to ask that let's Morocco at least give us freedom, because we are really under occupation there. And suddenly Trump with his Jared Kushner decided that if Morocco will accept Israel, okay, and have ties with Israel and open the diplomatic relations, we give the Sahrawi to Morocco. And he have no right to do it. There is no logic right or anything on that. And that's a new concept of colonization that will create a problem for African countries, other countries, where strong country could take the weak country, and we will have chaos in the whole world.
I think of how the French and the English drew up the borders of the Middle Eastern countries after World War I. French and German and English diplomats. Is this more of that?
Unfortunately, it's a white supremacy concept. It's a colonization concept. It's a power concept. I thought it was dead. It's gone. A lot of people fought. Algeria fought France, and they lost a million people for freedom. And other small countries, they are free and free and free.
So is this recolonization or one man's madness?
I think it's one man madness. And unfortunately, the Senate and people who are in power are unable to stop him. And they're afraid of him. They're afraid that if they stop him, the 70 million people who voted for him, they will kick them out of office. We are in a situation, a very, very bad situation. Unfortunately, on top of that, you have the virus that we have to deal with. We have the economic crisis we have to deal with. And if he sells $10 billion to Morocco, okay, of weapons. Morocco is not fighting anybody. Why all these weapons go to Morocco? Somebody is getting bakhshish. In Arabic, we call it bakhshish. Underground, under the carpet money. And he wants to get some money by selling weapons, it seems.
What is the future for the Western Saharan people?
Algeria have to go back to the UN and push hard on their behalf. Western Sahara people have to protest and wouldn't allow any of the Moroccan people to come and build anything. Then they have really to protest for anybody who's coming to the airport or to the fishing or to get some of their minerals, just to stop them by sitting in places and make the whole world understand this is wrong. Whatever is being done is wrong. The only thing that the Sahrawis can do is a nonviolent work.
Palestinian peace activist Mubarak Awad. Products in the military sales promised to the Kingdom of Morocco include weapons made by privately held General Atomics and Hellfire Paveway and JDAM precision guided munitions made by Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and Boeing. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz reports Kushner and his team are still holding talks with other countries from the Arab and Muslim world and hope to seal at least one more agreement before Trump leaves office on January 20th. And closer to home, the city was walloped with its biggest snowstorm in years overnight, leaving Central Park blanketed with 10 inches of snow as of 7 a.m. Thursday morning, and the Bronx with even more, according to city officials and meteorologists. Governor Andrew Cuomo spoke with reporters about the blizzard earlier today.
A newsflash, it snowed a lot in New York State. As of this morning, we had snow all across the state. Here in Kingston, we had about 15 inches, Albany about 21 inches, Binghamton in some place 2.5 feet in the southern tier in Binghamton, New York City about 3 to 4 inches, Long Island about 4 to 6 inches. The Department of Transportation, the Thruway, have done an excellent job in getting equipment out. Ulster County, the city of Kingston, likewise, they've done a great job.
And as Governor Cuomo, while the total snowfall was less than some forecasts predicted, the combination of wet, heavy snow and lingering cold temperatures could make for a slow cleanup and messy conditions over the next couple of days. And with restaurant owners and workers fearful of another shutdown because of coronavirus, Mayor de Blasio says with the city facing a crush for hospital space, it's time to just grin and bear it.
There's a lot of businesses hurting, not just restaurants, a whole lot of businesses hurting. Look, the challenge we have now is, let's go back to just the beginning here. Let's go back to the core of it. It's COVID. And the infection rate keeps rising. That's a big problem. That could lead to more and more stress on our hospitals. That's going to lead to more people losing their life, God forbid, but that's what's going to happen if we can't stop this. And it's going to end up shutting down the economy more and more anyway. So what I'm saying, I've had this conversation with the governor, and he and I have, you know, been very much of the same view on this, is if we don't turn this around quickly, the restrictions are the thing that stopped the situation from getting worse. We know that from the spring. We know that from the fall in Brooklyn and Queens. The restrictions stop the situation from getting worse and allow us to link up to when the vaccine has been spread around the community much more and reaches more and more people.
And that's the mayor. And finally, the New York Police Department will add another 900 cops to the force over the next 2 months to make up for the headcount reduced by this year's budget cuts. The department faced a $1 billion cut this year, forcing it to cancel its July class. These new recruits will enter the academy on a rolling basis starting on December 29th through February and are in addition to the class that began last month. The department is also gearing up to have members vaccinated for COVID-19 as Pfizer's first doses reach New York City. The mayor said the shots won't be mandatory. And that's some of the news for Thursday, December 17th, 2020. The news producer, Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From New York City, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News. Thanks for listening.